So on my notes, page one, that bold heading up there, there are, as I always say, a million different ways you could go with these topics, and every single Catholic topic is connected to every other Catholic topic, so when you kind of tug on one, they all kind of tug along with you, like taking a strand out of a tapestry. You pull the whole thing if you keep pulling, right? So how does one approach adoration? A million ways. I decided to land on this one. This is one angle tonight out of a whole bunch. I'm landing on from the Old Testament. So way back in the first part of the Bible. That's how we're going to do this. And to do that, I grabbed a story from the book of Exodus. All right? And I do it because I think that the Exodus story, in addition to being kind of cool, kind of gets at what I would call maybe the appeal or the essence of why adoration speaks to our hearts and why for over 1,000 years at least it has endured as a prayer practice among us as Catholics, something about it that captures us. And I think that the story gets at the kind of the kernel of what it is. It's so, I don't know, compelling and powerful about the way to pray that is Eucharistic adoration. As a disclaimer up front, my notes are in the back. If you actually got some here too if you want them. There's a folder in the back, and there's notes in the back, and the narthex. You're not late, you're okay. I promise. Anyway, you know, so adoration as something of a spoiler alert, okay? This is when we take the Eucharist, so we call it a host in Catholic parlance. A host is a blessed Eucharistic bread. We put it on the altar so that we can look at it, and we can adore it. That's Eucharistic adoration. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. So to build up to that, Exodus. I'm going to read these verses from Exodus, and this is Exodus 33 and 34, pieces of it. I skip over a couple of pieces that kind of go in different tangents on the story, but these three big sections here are the kernel of a very important Old Testament story. So I'll read this, and then we're going to use this to unpack adoration a little bit, and to kind of pull out of it some things that maybe we can learn from and know that this is a meaningful and great thing to do. So here we go. Moses used to pitch a tent outside the camp at some distance. It was called the Tent of Meeting. Anyone who wished to consult the Lord would go to the Tent of Meeting outside the camp. Whenever Moses went out of the tent, the people would all rise and stand at the entrance of their own tents, watching Moses until he entered the tent. As Moses entered the tent, the column of cloud would come down and stand at its entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. On seeing the column of cloud stand at the entrance of the tent, all the people would rise and bow down at the entrance of their own tents. The Lord used to speak to Moses face to face, as a person speaks to a friend. Moses would then return to the camp, but his young assistant, Joshua, son of Nun, never left the tent. Then Moses said, "Please let me see your glory." The Lord answered, "I will make all my goodness pass before you, and I'll proclaim my name, Lord, before you, I who show favor to whom I will, I who grant mercy to whom I will. But you cannot see my face, for no one can see me and live. Here, continued the Lord, is a place near me where you shall station yourself on the rock. When my glory passes, I will set you in the cleft of the rock and will cover you with my hand until I have passed by. Then I'll remove my hand so that you may see my back, but my face may not be seen." The Lord came down in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name Lord. So the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, a God gracious and merciful, slow to anger and abounding in love and fidelity, continuing his love for 1,000 generations and forbidding wickedness, rebellion, and sin, yet not declaring the guilty guiltless, but bringing punishment for their parents' wickedness on their children and children's children, to the third and fourth generation. Moses at once knelt and bowed down to the ground. And he said, "If I find favor with you, Lord, please, Lord, come along in our company. This is indeed a stiff-necked people, yet pardon our wickedness and sins and claim us as your own." This is a great little story, and maybe you've heard it before, maybe you haven't, it's a smidge, you know, obscure, but it is, in fact, deep in the heart of the Old Testament. And so what we're going to do is we'll kind of use this as something of a springboard to adoration. And it is connected to the story, and hopefully maybe you can see some connections already, but I'll tease them out as we go here, okay? So to get there, first of all, some key points from the story just in general, without even talking about adoration specifically, although it comes to bear. key things in general. First of all, this concept of the meeting tent as a dwelling place for God among his people. This is a really, really cool thing that God does, right? Now, put yourself for a second in the context of the Old Testament people. They would have been in Egypt as slaves for a century or two. They would have known the Israeli God, but kind of distantly, because their minds had grown dark about the origins of their Israeli faith, so they were starting to kind of lose their sense of God a little bit, just a smidge. But they found themselves under oppression in Egypt, and they cry out to God, you know, help us, get us out of here. God raises up Moses. Moses leads them out of Egypt through a series of wondrous acts that God does on their behalf. So he, if you know the story, he essentially makes Pharaoh get so disgusted with their presence that he sends them out, because God does all these horrific things to finally make Pharaoh realize, these people don't belong to you, Pharaoh, they belong to me. Out they go, through the desert, across the Red Sea, in a dramatic act of power, God destroys the Egyptian army, all the foes of the Israelites are vanquished. They get out to the desert, and here's where the story begins to shape up. Now they're out there alone with God, it's just them and God. And when they're out there, they complain, they cry, they moan, they grumble. It's like a long car trip. If you've ever taken kids across the country, you know what this is like, right? Here you go, okay, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? They'd say to God about every other page, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? What happens is, God does a really wonderful thing. He decides to move in among them. He moves in among them as a way to show them that he wasn't going to leave them by themselves. He was not going to abandon them. Even for all the complaining and the bickering, and they did it constantly, he says, I love you, you're my people, I want to live among you, here's how you're going to do it. He says to Moses one day, a couple chapters before this one, I want you to make me a tent. These were traveling nomadic people. If you go to Israel today, you can see the Bedouin, they are nomads, they live in big tents, and they move around with the flocks. They follow their herds across the deserts. These were nomadic people. They knew what a tent was. It was a dwelling place. So God says, I'll tell you what, you guys know tents? Make a tent, okay? And make it like these dimensions. In the middle of the tent, make an altar. And God says, I'm going to move into the tent. And you know that I'm there when this cloud of presence shows up. And that's where I will visit with your leaders, Moses and Joshua, and also Aaron, Moses' brother, will go in there. And when it's time to go, I'll tell you, you're going to pack up the tent, and I'm going to lead you by a column across the desert. You're going to see me in the day and the night. I'm going to lead you on, and then when it's time to stop, we're going to stop. You're going to put the tent back up. I'll go back in the tent, and I'm going to lead you that way for years and years and years until you get to the promised land. So the tent is this privileged place where God, who is unseen, who is vast, who is uncontainable, who makes the heavens and the earth, decides to do something remarkably humble. He decides to move into a dwelling, and he stays near his people. I mean, the word is condescending, right? What a lowly thing for the grand God to do, but says, gosh, what do they want? I'll live in a tent, okay? I'll live in a tent. If that's what it takes to get you to love me, I'll live in a blessed tent, right? So there he is. This is how our God is. He is grand and becomes small. He is mighty and becomes lowly. And he is so concerned for us, not thinking that he's going to walk out on us or abandon us, that he moves in. So the story highlights the tent, right? And we should know this is an extremely important part of our history. What's going to eventually happen, okay, is that they're going to get the promised land, and the ark will be in this tent, which is where the commandments are kept, and they're going to get to Jerusalem finally, and after a while, the kings are going to say, you know, we should make God a better house in this tent. So they build a temple, which is just a stone version of the tent, which doesn't move around, it just stays in one spot on the hilltop on Mount Zion, and there God lives in the temple. Eventually, we'll fast forward lots of years and years and years, any Christian church, any Catholic church is really just a mini version of the tent and the temple. This is just a new copy of it, right? So here is God's house, here is his tent. Actually, this building looks a smidge like one. Use your imagination, you know. Think of it as a teepee, if you will. So, and guess what? What do we have here? We have a tabernacle where the candle is burning, the red one, right? The word tabernacle means, guess what? Tent. That's what it comes from. So that is our tent, because who lives there? The living God. So this whole idea of our conception of a God who lives in buildings and in sacred spaces and in temples and in tabernacles comes from this story. And this is thousands of years old. He's been living in a tent for thousands of years. Okay? And I'll do you a bunch better, okay? The perfect tent is going to be his son Jesus. He says, the temple is great, but I'll come in person. How about that? That'd be even better, which he does, and we kill him. We'll get to that later in the year, right? But so, anyway, this is a God who dwells. He dwells among his people. That's the point. He does it then and now. That second bullet point from the bottom of my page one notes, okay, the desire to see the face of God. It has been a long, long-standing human desire to look upon God. We want to see God face to face. And if you were Israeli, if you're Jewish, this is a really big deal because your neighbors who were pagans, they had visible gods. They were statues. They were figurines. They were nature gods. They could carve them, and they made them out of bronze or out of copper, sometimes out of gold, and you could carry your gods around in procession, and if you put them in the right spot during a certain time of the year, then you could make it rain, and you could sacrifice to the gods so you could have children, and you could sacrifice, you could conquer your neighbors and have the wheat crops grow. So all the pagans had visible gods, and the Israelites, they always kind of felt left out, like, we don't get to see our God. Okay, this is not any fun. And this is, they will talk about it in that way in the Old Testament, like, we're getting cheated here, you know? But the unseen God, though, showed them over and over again that while they couldn't see him, he was real, he was powerful, and he was alive, and he took good care of them, which you couldn't say about any of the pagan gods. And they figured this out as time passes. Nonetheless, if you're an Israelite, you want to see your God. You want to see God face to face. It's this human longing to look upon God, to gaze at him, and to see him, and to know that he sees us. This is true for us, too. I think it's a very difficult thing for Christians in a very sensory, tangible world that we live in with screens and visual things and all this stuff to believe in an invisible God. But God asks us today to believe in him in the same way. I'm not visible, he says, but I am here. So we, too, want to see him face to face. Okay? So that's in this story. We get Moses here, the leader. We get the tent. And then we have Moses talking to God face to face, which is a rare, rare privilege. Only a handful of people get to do that. All right? Now, the face to face is going to be qualified a bit as the verses move down because it's not a true face to face encounter. It's something of a shadow reflection of it because God says, we'll get to this in a second, if you see me, you're going to die. So there's always this kind of, you know, border zone here. Okay. Nonetheless, okay, God, Moses says this, and then he says, let me see your face further down. So Moses is articulating the desire in all of our hearts. Let me see your face. Okay? If we have a loved one, a husband, a wife, children, parents, we want to look on the people that we love. It's an expression of love. So we understand what he's trying to say. Bottom point, and I just touched on this, Moses does get the rare, rare Old Testament privilege, which almost nobody gets, to speak to God face to face. In the meeting tent, he can do that. And the word for this, you see it here, ad oratio, that's Latin, that's mouth to mouth or face to face. Adoration comes from face to face. That's what it means. So to speak about Eucharistic adoration, we'll be talking about talking to God face to face. Ad oratio, mouth to mouth. It's a very intimate, beautiful way to pray. We will look upon the face of God in adoration. That's the idea. Second page. Again, generic points. No one can see me and live. Death will be as required to see God face to face. All right, God says, you want to see me face to face, you're going to have to die. You must die or you cannot see me face to face. We can take this on different layers. And I forgot to indent these below, but the next three bullet points are how this happens, the different kinds of death. The first one is bodily death. This is something of the easiest one to figure out. The idea, the Christian vision of heaven, okay, is the fact that we see God face to face, but to get to that kind of unfiltered vision, unmediated vision, but face to face without anything impeding us, to get to that point, you can only get there if you die. There's no getting to heaven if you're alive in this life. It just doesn't work. After Adam and Eve made their tragic mistake and death enters the world, God says, all right, I'm going to use this now, this death thing that you caused, as a pathway to get to me. I'm going to redeem it. I'm going to fix it. You're going to fear it. You're not going to like it. You're going to spend your whole life fighting against it with every medical thing you can think of, but the fact is you're not going to escape it. No matter how many times you're vaccinated or medicated or whatever, you will die. And when you finally do, if you are good, you will see me face to face. So, our desire to see God face to face is only answered in death. That's one way that this story is true. When God says, if you see me, you're going to die, he's talking about that. There's more. We can't get through death all by ourselves and see God face to face. He must pull us across that deadly space. And so the second point down there, the death of God in Christ. What God is saying in this passage is he's making a prediction. One day I'll come among you myself, and I will die in your place. And therefore, that death will let you see me face to face. I will come among you. You will gaze on me in Jesus Christ of Nazareth. You will gaze on me and my son. You will gaze upon him on the cross. You will gaze upon him when he dies. In that death, you will see me face to face. Because he will die and he will rise, he will make it possible for your death to come to me. In his death and my death of sacrifice of love, you will see me face to face. So he says it. You can't see me without death. You can't see me without that death. That death makes it possible. So God's not being mean here. He's not being an angry parent. You know, you got to die, you're going to see me face to face. He's making a prediction about his own act of love. I will die so you can see me face to face, because he knows that we can't pull it off. And lastly, the death to sin in the hearts of believers. If we're going to see God face to face, something in us must die. Vice, corruption, evil, bad thoughts, bad actions, sin, those things must die. And if we put them to death in this life, then we see God more clearly in this life, in the faces of those around us, and we make it to the next life, we see him in his fullness. So death to sin is required to see him face to face. So the story of the meeting tent, and God and Moses saying, can I see you face to face? And God says, well, no, not without death. Different levels, bodily death, my death, God says, and your death to sin. Those things will let me see you face to face. When we get to the Eucharist, okay, it's possible because of all those deaths. Right? It's a foretaste of heavenly reality. It's a dying of the senses. It's all these things. Okay? A couple more points from the story in general that I got on the top of page 2 there. The glory of God, the mercy of God, the disposition and posture of people who watch from their tents and bow, and the tenderness of God who protects Moses with his hand. This is a mighty, mighty God. And it's clear in the story, there's this kind of thundery scene at the end where the God passes by. But what does he do? He says to Moses, okay, look, if you saw my raw power, it would fry you, okay? You know, like a mosquito in a microwave. So we're not going to do that. No, God says, I'll tell you what, I'll shield you with myself so you won't get hurt. This is a metaphorical way of speaking in the language. It's imagery, but the ancient author is trying to say, God finds a way in his mercy to keep Moses from getting hurt by his power. God says, you can't handle my unmediated presence. It's too much for you. So since you want to see me so badly, I'll devise a way to let you do it. And in my mercy, my kindness, I'm going to protect you. So God is mighty and he is small. And he finds a way to shield us from his raw, awesome power so that we're not destroyed by him just being in his presence. Because we're so other, God says, just so you don't get hurt, I'll find a way to let you see me. So his presence is therefore mediated. That's the word. It passes through something. Because to handle him raw, we couldn't do it. Okay? General points. Next section down, some points on adoration. Inform of the story from Exodus. So we got some generic points, right? Now, you ought to be getting, I think, closer to what adoration means from these generic points. The Catholic belief about the Eucharist has always been that it's an encounter with the real presence of God. So, we want to see God face to face. What does God do? He lives among us. tent, Jesus. Now for us as Catholics, we say he lives in his sacraments. He lives in the church. For he lives in the waters of baptism. He lives on the altar. He lives in the tabernacle. He lives in the celebration, the ritual of the Mass, and in the gestures. And so, therefore, as Catholics, we say, no matter what, when you come to Mass, whether you're tuned in or not, you are in the presence of the living God. You're in the meeting tent. You are like Moses and Joshua. When you come through that door and you come into church, you're in his presence. And when you're a part of the Mass, you're in his presence in action, you might say. There's an action in the Mass that's dynamic, that is powerful, that brings us up into its own life and rhythm and dynamic. So we'd say, okay, like the Exodus story, Mass is the meeting tent, and seeing God is what happens here. So all that's at work. All that's at work, all right? To continue, next point down, it's an extension of our continuation of Christ's crucified and risen presence in the world, of God dwelling among us. So the Eucharist on the altar is God's presence, and to deepen that just a smidge, we know this is a historical fact and a theological one, that God's Son comes among us. He lives, he dies, he rises. That is the heart of our faith. The unseen God is born and becomes seen. He lives, he dies, he rises. We must understand that that is true. The Catholic goes one step further and says not only that, he takes that very presence of himself, crucified and risen, and he puts it on the altar. In the tabernacle and on the altar is the crucified and risen presence of Jesus Christ. That's who it is. So it's not just a symbol, it's not just a gesture, it's not just bread. We say, this is the living God. You're going to encounter him here in a way you can't encounter him in any other possible mode. If one wants to today, one can go to Jerusalem, and one can stand in the tomb, because it's all been very nicely preserved. You can stand in the place, and I have done so, where the Lord rose from the dead. Okay, so that is a raw, historical, theological reality. It's cool as it is to be there, and I'm happy to go there. The fact is, it's more real having him in a tabernacle. This is really him. The tomb is a place. This is a person. You see? There's a difference. You heard me tell the story before. When I was in Jerusalem, I spent a lot of time there, and I used to like to go up to the church that's built over the place of Mount Calvary where he died, and the tomb. They're only a few feet apart. And I would go early in the mornings to pray up there, and the pilgrims are there, and it's kind of a crazy place, and Jerusalem's just kind of a unique place to be anyway. But the point is, while it's great to sit on Calvary, you can like sit right there on the rock, and you can look at the rock, and you can look where the cross was, and the tomb is behind you down this little balcony thing. I felt the closest to God in the Blessed Sacrament Chapel, which was across this side of the church, because the tabernacle was there. Okay? So I love the tomb, I love the cross, but they weren't a tabernacle. That's the living God. That's the living God, right? To be in the Eucharist presence, to be in his presence, all right? Third point down in that second section. This is a mediated presence because we experience through our senses and through the matter of sacrament, bread, and wine. And the next point, it's a fulfillment of the meeting tent, the column of cloud. It's a bit like God sheltering Moses with his hand, because we would die if we experienced God's full, unmediated power. God is so kind to us. So like the tent story, right? God says, I'll pass in front of you. You can see my back. Here's my hand so I don't fry you, okay? The Eucharist is the same thing. God says, okay, you can't handle me, my raw power, so I will come to you through bread. I'll come to you through wine. It's mediated. There's a medium. There's a shielding. God says, until you are in heaven, you can't handle it. But for right now, I'll do it this way, like shelter you at my hand. Because if I didn't do this, you'd be dead. Okay? I mean, when God shows up, you're dead. Okay? Unless he cloaks himself and kind of masks himself and kind of makes himself small out of love for us. So the Eucharist is a very, very tender thing. It's a sheltering of us, okay? And it's so deceptive because, I mean, you look at it and you think, gosh, it looks like a piece of bread, and it does. But the Catholic says, in our eyes of faith, yeah, but I know it's not bread. It may look like it may smell like it may taste like it, but my faith teaches me that it's not. It's God. But he's passing through a substance so that I'm not destroyed by being in his presence. Okay? So it's just like this story. It's just like this story. To be the presence of the Eucharist, Blessed Sacrament, is to be in close proximity to God's essential presence on this earth. I think that point's been made. Two extra little historical pieces that get us down to the last section, okay. We have from the first century AD a couple of descriptions that are written down and were preserved of what the early Mass was like in the first 100 years of Christianity, which is a really cool thing to read. It's really, really neat. And it looks remarkably like it looks today. Like, if you read this description, you can get it anywhere. It's all over the internet, you know. You'd say, wow, that's like we do it on Sunday. It's pretty much it. It's been that constant for 2,000 years, right? So what did they do? They had Mass, and they would have had it in secret. They would have had it on Sunday, which was new because the Jewish worship day was Saturday. Sunday was the beginning of the work week for Roman territories and for Jewish territories, too. For us, it's Monday. For them, it was Sunday. So on the first day of the work week, they gathered for worship because it was the day Jesus rose. He rose on a Sunday. We know that by really good historical evidence. They gather on a Sunday in secret in houses with a priest huddled among them, and they break the bread. They know it's his presence among them. It's the meeting tent. It's face to face. There he is. And then what do? They began early on to hang on to bits and pieces of the Eucharist in a special box so that the deacons could take it to the sick during the week who couldn't make it to Mass. So they began a practice of preserving the Eucharist early on so that way the sick could have it who couldn't make it to services. Think of it like being in quarantine today, or you know, we're all very kind of scattered right now with our worship practices. We take communion to the homebound. They did it back then too. It was a pretty easy leap for them then, after a century or two, to go, you know, wait a minute. So we got this Mass thing happening, and we got this tabernacle, and we know that the Eucharist in the tabernacle is an extension of the Mass and the risen Christ. Wouldn't it be cool to pray in front of the tabernacle? So they began to do that. Especially when Christianity becomes legal in the 300s and they can start building churches, grand, beautiful churches. And what do they have in them? They had tabernacles, and they were open, and pilgrims would come and they would pray in there, and they began to realize, this is a great space to pray, because God is here. So the practice of keeping it for the sick, which is the first reason they did it, secondarily becomes a way to pray, which is why most folks come here today. They pray because they want to be near the Lord. So fast forward now, okay, we got this long tradition of being in for a tabernacle. My last big section on page 2, do let me see your face, right? This is from Moses. Well, we all want to see God face to face, right? It doesn't take long for them to figure out that if you can pray before a tabernacle, surely you could take him out of there, and you could put him in a glass container, and you can look at him. You can look at him face to face, adoratio, adoration. That's what they do. So adoration as a practice begins by taking what's in the tabernacle and taking it out so you can look at it and you can adore it. And you can marvel at it. Think of the meeting tent, right? Think of the people in the meeting tent story, I skipped over this, who they stand at their tents to watch Moses. They're like watching him, and then when he goes in, they bow down, okay? They were doing it back then. So when the Eucharist comes out, the people, they bow down and they kneel down. In the Middle Ages, so about 1,000 years ago, it was not very common for people to receive communion by mouth. That tended to be reserved for only the clergy, sometimes people in monasteries. They had gotten such a deep, deep sense of almost fear, but they didn't want to take it. What they could do, though, is they would all go to Mass. Nobody missed Mass, because they wouldn't dare do that, okay? But when you came to Mass, you watched it, and the highlight of the Mass was when the priest, who had his back to the time, would elevate the host and you could see it. And he held it up for a long time because they could look at it. That was their communion. That was adoration. So it became very common Middle Ages to, when Mass was done, take that host and put it on the altar in the glass thing, and they just kept watching it, and that's how they prayed. So it was Eucharistic communion with a visible face-to-face thing. Okay? Really, really powerful stuff. Right? So that's what we do today. This is just kind of how it goes. Eucharistic adoration simply means that at a Mass, right, we take bread, which is brought up in the gift table probably, which I have right here for the moment, put it on the altar, and as the Mass goes on and God's word's proclaimed and I pray over it and you pray with me, the Holy Spirit comes down upon the bread and the wine, it becomes the body and the blood, I take it, I bless it, I break it, I give it to you who are able to receive it. Adoration simply means that I've kind of stopped that process and like paused it. I've taken it, I've blessed it, and then before I break it and give it, I stop and I let you look at it for like a long time. Okay? So adoration is something like an extension of the Mass through time. It's like a Mass on pause. It's like I like to always describe it, okay? So that's all this is. We put it in what's called, this is almost toward the bottom here, a monstrance, which comes from, you know the word demonstrate? Same root word, to display, to show, to convey something. A monstrance is a shower of the Eucharist, of a host. Host in the Latin word hostia, which means victim, which means we're looking at the victim, the one who's been sacrificed, the one who's been offered. Why? Because we all want to look at God face to face. So it really goes back to this meeting tent story. I mean, if you want to know why adoration is so powerful, why it endures, why for over 1,000 years plus it's kind of held up as this Catholic prayer practice, I really think it comes down to its sensory impact. Like, you can see it. You can see it. And when the Eucharist is on the altar and the monstrance, okay, I mean, it's cool in the tabernacle, but when you can look at the host, and then your senses are engaged in a whole new level. And God knows that we are sensory people. That's why he allows us to do this. That's why he says to Moses, all right, you want to see me? Stand over here, and I'll go like this. I'll give you what you want. Okay? He says to us, you want to see me? All right, fine. Come here. You can put me in a piece of glass, and you can look at me. Okay? Mediated, because if it was my raw power, you'd be dead. But out of compassion for you, I'll veil myself and look like a piece of bread, and you can handle it. So God's very generous, and this is very appealing, right? So we're tangible sensory people. That's why we tend to go for these things. It does make some sense. Page 3, last pieces here, okay. How do we respond? So the Catholic practices put a monstrance on the altar. We will probably incense it. We incense divine things. It's a sign of the fact that we know who it is. It's a deity. It is God. It's the deity, and not a deity, the deity. And then what do? We do what the people in the story from Exodus do. What does Moses do? He falls down flat on his face. He kneels. He realizes that to be in God's presence like that brings about in oneself a real degree of unworthiness. Okay? And not self-hatred, not self-loathing, those are psychologically bad things. No, no, no. It's a real sense of there's the other and there's me. And of the two of us, one's way mightier. Okay? I am not God. You are not God. I'm not in charge. He is. And the modern mind has to learn the lesson over and over and over again because we think that we're in charge with all of our gadgets and might and medicines and science. We think we're so amazing. God says, you're not. Okay, I mean, you do great things with what I give you, but the fact is I'm God and you are not. So to be a sense of unworthy means that we realize our place. And we realize that this mighty, wonderful God kind of lifts us up in his hands and says, yes, you're unworthy and yes, you're small, but I'm crazy about you. I love you, and I'm going to lift you up to bring you close to me because I just do that like a tender parent. So in that story, it's really cool. I mentioned this a second ago. You know, Moses goes in the tent, and what all the people do at the entrance to their own little living tents, they kneel, they bow down. It's like they recognize that prayer is going on, and they're going to acknowledge God's there. Same thing. We'll put the mountains on the altar. Eucharist will be there. We kneel, or we go prostrate. Okay? So all of this is the response of a people who realize who they're in front of. Okay? So that's kind of it, right? That's in a nutshell. I mean, on I could go, but I think you kind of get the basic idea, right? So for some etiquette, protocol, whatnot, in a minute here, I'm gonna have to stop and get myself ready for adoration, and you will too. You have an order of worship, I think, maybe in front of you. On the cover of this thing, you got these angels. That's a monstrance, that thing in the middle, and that's a host in the middle of it, right? We have one here. It's not nearly as decorative as that, but a monstrance is a monstrance is a monstrance. It'll work. If you open up to the inside cover on page 2, we have it's called a Eucharistic hymn, the O Salutaris Hostia, O Saving Victim. It's Latin. And this was composed by Thomas Aquinas, who is a saint who had, among other things, a brilliant love of the Eucharist and wrote these beautiful hymns about it. So when Jesus is exposed, it's customary for us in song to express our amazement at who he is. O Saving Victim, opening wide the gates of heaven to us below. So the English is not in here, but I mean, you can look it up. It is all about the fact that we realize God has come. And we kneel. Okay? Usually, it's good to sit in silence before the Eucharist because we need quiet in our lives. We won't do that tonight so much because, to be honest, we can't handle quiet, so we're going to kind of ease you into this slowly. Put the Eucharist on the altar, be quiet for a minute or two. And then we're going to do the rosary, at least one decade, so that's the prayers are in here. And when we get to that part, I'll invite the children who are with us to come up by me, and they'll help me pray the rosary. We'll do it together as a way to kind of bring them close to Jesus on the altar. Okay? And the rosary prayers are here. If you don't know what the rosary is, we'll come back to that later, but it's another way for Catholics to pray in a structured kind of way that lets us focus our prayers on the closeness of the Blessed Mother to her son Jesus. Okay? Father Carlos, who will be with in a minute, is going to read this portion of John's Gospel about the food in the desert. This is the Exodus story. And we'll turn the page. We'll sing a little song, which I think our young people will relate to. Sit in silence for a smidge longer, and then benediction is simply a Latin word to be blessed. That's a blessing for you. And the way that works is, I will take the monstrance on the altar under a cloak, which I have to get out. I see I forgot that. And I move the monstrance over you like a cross, and you bless yourselves because the Eucharist is blessing you. So it's like God's way of kind of saying goodnight. They're tucking you in, saying, you know, and imparting his presence with us. And as you leave, you kind of take it with you, right? And there's some other prayers and things too, which we'll do. I'll lead you through all those things. They're on the page 6 there. These are ways to praise the sacrament, and we'll end with the Holy God, we praise the name. Okay? So I just encourage you to just try and be, if you've not done this before, it might be totally new for you, and I understand that. So do what you can do to just kind of try and be open to what's going on, but it's going to depend upon your ability in your mind to tell yourself, and it might be hard at first, but I promise you a time will come. This whole thing will depend upon you telling yourself, I know that God's in front of me. I know that God's in front of me. Okay? You got to come back to that over and over again. And if your mind wanders, which it does in prayer, happens all the blessed time, just keep saying, I know that God's in front of me. Let that bring you back. And when as that seeps into head and heart, then one is moved by it. Okay? I know that God's in front of me. I know that God's in front of me.